I'm not sure how many more months I have where I can speak well enough that I can be understood, but I plan to spend every one of those months doing everything I can. As my life is coming to the end, I want to make my son proud. Rachel knows that this may be one of the last times that I can bird dog a senator or speak at a rally. She's sacrificing so that we can do this. I admire her and appreciate her so much.
Audie Barkin speaking in a clip from the new documentary Not Going Quietly, premiering this weekend in L.A., in New York, and beyond. And we want to thank Nicholas Bruckman, the film's director. That does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for our video production fellowship and our digital fellowship here in New York City studios. The deadline is this weekend. You can learn more and apply today at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present Long Strange Trip, The History of the Grateful Dead, Saturday, August 21st, at 6 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. This Grateful Dead documentary will be shown as a benefit for KBOO to celebrate 20 years of Grateful Dead and Friends on the air. This is an all-ages event, and masks are required. You can buy tickets at kboo.fm and support KBOO getting a new studio transmitter link. Again, that's Long Strange Trip, a benefit for KBOO at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland, on Saturday, August 21st at 6 p.m.
Tune in to Higher Reasoning Reggae every Sunday morning at 3 a.m. Higher Reasoning Reggae is dedicated to bringing international reggae word and sound power to the massive airing early Sunday mornings at 3 a.m. only on KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, high temperatures prompt an extreme heat warning for most of the region. Wildfire smoke blankets Oregon, worsening air quality. And the indoor mask mandate is back on. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 13th, 2021. I'm Sam Bowman. An extreme heat warning is in effect from southern Washington down through Oregon to Lane County until Saturday evening. This warning is issued when the heat is a threat to lives or property, and it means that within 12 hours, temperatures will hit 105 degrees. Wildfire smoke drifting in may prevent some places from breaking triple digits, but the heat's effects will still be felt. Even though this heat wave is not as hot as the record-breaking one we saw in June, it's still a threat to health and well-being. Oregon leaders declared a state of emergency related to heat waves in the region earlier this month, which frees up state, county, and tribal authorities to better address the problem. Four cooling centers in Multnomah County will be open 24 hours through Sunday morning. Those are the Arbor Lodge Shelter, the Sunrise Center, Kellogg Middle School, and the Portland Building. Local libraries have extended some of their hours to act as cooling centers, and TriMet encourages people to get to and from the cooling centers on public transit, even if they are unable to pay the fare. Residents are recommended to check their county's online resources to find cooling centers nearby, including calling 211. Haze and smog from wildfires across the state have blanketed Oregon and degraded the air quality in much of the state. This includes many counties: Multnomah, Clackamas, Washington, Lane, Linn, and Marion counties in the Willamette Valley, Crook, Deschutes, and Jefferson counties in central Oregon, Baker, Grant, Harney, Malheur, Morrow, Umatilla, Union, and Wallowa counties in eastern Oregon, Curry, Douglas, Jackson, Klamath, and Lake counties in southern Oregon are also impacted. All of these areas are under an air quality advisory from the Department of Environmental Quality until Monday afternoon. Smoke can worsen some medical conditions and will irritate the respiratory system of most people. It's recommended that residents stay inside when they can with the windows and doors closed and avoid strenuous activity. Cloth facial masks won't block out the harmful particles from wildfire smoke. Only N95 masks or P100 respirators worn properly can do that. There are currently 16 major wildfires burning in Oregon. Officials fear that the extreme heat this weekend and possible lightning storms could make for new fire starts and challenge existing firefighting. As of Thursday, over 500,000 acres have burned this year. Most of that comes from the massive Bootleg Fire, which fire crews have contained 98%. Climate change is impacting people's health. Worsening heat and pollen are sending people to the hospital in noticeably higher numbers. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Renee Salas is an emergency medicine doctor at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. For her, global warming is not some abstract future threat.
I'm already seeing ways in which climate change is contributing to health harms in my patients in Boston today. Whether it's illness due to more extreme heat, like an elderly man living in lower income housing without air conditioning, suffering heat stroke, or a young girl with repeated emergency department visits due to asthma attacks as climate change drives pollen to be higher.
Global warming is also worsening wildfires, which create smoke that's harmful to breathe. It's increasing the prevalence of tick and mosquito-borne illnesses, and it's causing more extreme and dangerous storms. The consequences go beyond human suffering. Increased hospital admissions, emergency department visits, and long-term treatment cost a lot of money.
It can fall on the individual, can fall on the insurance company or the government, or on the hospital system. So that means we're all bearing the burden in some way, and thus we have to work together to get to the root cause
and reduce global warming. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
A challenge to Indiana University's vaccine requirement was rejected without consideration from the Supreme Court. KBOO's Josh Salem has more.
The United States Supreme Court will not block an Indiana University requirement that students be vaccinated against coronavirus. 8 students sued the university, claiming violation of constitutional rights to bodily integrity, autonomy, and medical treatment choice. The ban allowed exceptions for religious, ethical, and medical reasons. Even opponents of the prohibition conceded nearly everyone seeking an exemption would get one. The students submitted an emergency application seeking an injunction against the ban. Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who oversees the federal appeals court involved, turned down the request without commenting on it. She did not refer the application to the full court and did not seek a response from Indiana University. Some feel Barrett's actions indicate the application did not have a solid legal basis. The students' argument included a claim the vaccine requirement puts them at risk. Their lawyer said, quote, "Unknown risks associated with COVID vaccines, particularly in those under 30, outweigh the risk to that population from the disease itself," end quote. This was the first potential COVID vaccination case involving an educational institution that reached the Supreme Court. The court has ruled on other emergency applications involving religious institutions and prisons. A trial judge in a unanimous panel of the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit declined to block the ban while the students' appeal moved forward. Health exams and vaccinations for diseases like tetanus and meningitis are common requirements to attend many colleges. The Court of Appeals stated, quote, "People who do not want to be vaccinated may go elsewhere. Plaintiffs have ample educational opportunities," end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
New racial and ethnic data from the Census Bureau could prove critical to redistricting efforts. With that story and more, it's Lily Bolke with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The 2020 census results show that the U.S. population is much more multiracial and more racially and ethnically diverse than what we measured in the past.
Nicholas Jones, Director of Race and Ethnic Research and Outreach for the U.S. Census Bureau, detailed data from the 2020 census, which show population growth in the last decade has largely been driven by increases in the number of Latino and Asian American residents. The data is critical for redistricting, drawing new voting district maps for the next decade of elections. Katie Blair with the ACLU of Indiana says lines should be drawn to reflect changes in population and racial diversity, but contends when politicians draw the maps, they can dilute the voting power of the minority party or further marginalize communities of color.
By packing communities of color into too small of districts, or by cracking communities of color and spreading them out over many districts.
Advocates for fair maps hope the people charged with drawing districts will take into account what are known as communities of interest. Elliot MC with the LGBTQ Victory Fund notes LGBTQ people have historically been absent from discussions of redistricting, even though the process is so consequential for LGBTQ representation.
A line drawn in the middle of a neighborhood with a large LGBTQ population can be the difference between electing an LGBTQ person to a city council or having zero LGBTQ people on that city council.
A report released this week by the Campaign Legal Center grades states on whether they have 10 key voting practices, from no-excuse absentee voting to online tracking of mail-in ballots and ballot drop boxes. Only Illinois and Washington checked all the boxes. Alabama finished last. Denise Lieberman, the former head of the Advancement Project's Voting Rights Program, says 2020's high voter participation triggered more than 400 voting-related bills introduced in state legislatures.
Heading into 2021, fueled by the big lie, was a full-out assault on the very measures that made voting accessible in 2020 due to the pandemic.
The latest was yesterday in Texas, where the legislature passed a bill to make it harder and riskier to vote, even after Texas Democrats filibustered and fled to Washington, D.C., trying to stop it. Also in Washington, President Joe Biden urged Congress to lower prescription drug prices, in part by allowing Medicare to negotiate with drug companies.
The price of many prescription drugs has dramatically outpaced inflation. These prices have put the squeeze on too many families and stripped them of their dignity.
Finally, military and administration officials said yesterday they're bracing for a collapse of the Afghan government, and diplomats are trying to gain assurances from the Taliban they won't attack the U.S. embassy in Kabul. I'm Lily Bolke for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Cole Hemstreet contributed reporting.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Let's Talk About Race. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be a warm and clear with a low of 69 degrees. Tomorrow, the heat continues with a high of 98. An extreme heat advisory is in effect for much of the Northwest Oregon region and Southwest Washington until Saturday night at 10 p.m. Today in history, in 1946, English author H.G. Wells died. He produced many works across genres, but he is best remembered for his contributions to science fiction and is often called a father of the genre. The quote of the day is from H.G. Wells, who said, quote, "Adapt or perish, now as ever, is nature's inexorable imperative." Thank you. Tribes in Wisconsin are opposing a state-approved wolf hunt this fall. With that story and more, it's Trip Krause with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Trip Krause in for Antonia Gonzalez. A policy-setting board for Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources approved a wolf harvest quota of 300 wolves for the state's fall wolf hunt. Wisconsin tribes oppose the hunt and have called on the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to reconsider its decision to remove federal protections for the animal. Daniel Kading reports.
The board's vote goes against the Wisconsin DNR's recommendation to set the harvest at 130 wolves. State wildlife managers supported a conservative harvest due to uncertainty over the population's response to the February wolf hunt. State licensed hunters harvested nearly double their allotted quota, killing 218 wolves in less than 72 hours. John Johnson Sr. is president of the Lac du Flambeau Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. He told the board that tribes view the wolf as a brother, adding their fates are intertwined.
Since Native people lived in coexistence with wolves for longer than Europeans have walked North America, the main gun we know, respect, and understand seems to be a different animal than the wolf that so many others despise.
Johnson also chairs the Voight Intertribal Task Force, which represents Ojibwe tribes. The task force has called on the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to reconsider the wolf's delisting due to Wisconsin's systemic failures to manage wolves and prevent overharvest. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
The U.S. Senate passed a $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure package that includes key spending provisions related to transportation, water infrastructure, energy, and climate resiliency. On Wednesday, the National Congress of American Indians held a virtual panel to discuss an infrastructure bill which proposes more than $15 billion in direct funding for tribal nations. Amber Ebarb is Deputy Staff Director at the U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs and spoke to the NCAI panel.
We know Native communities are facing some of the most extreme impacts of climate change, especially in the Arctic. So this bill helps build climate change resilience in Native communities. And we know there's always need for more, but at least for now in the BIA, the bill includes $130 million for community relocation and $86 million for tribal climate resilience and adaptation projects.
C.C. Wright is policy lead for community development and infrastructure for the National Congress of American Indians. During the panel, Wright said the infrastructure bill authorizes more than $270 million over 6 years to implement eligible water projects to improve sanitation under the EPA's Indian Reservation Drinking Water Program. It also includes funding for sanitation projects in Alaska Native villages.
It includes $290 million over 5 years to administer grants in Alaska that will improve sanitation in rural and Native villages. $40 million annually for FY 22 through 24, $50 million for FY 25, and $60 million for FY 26.
The U.S. House is expected to take up the bill this fall. Here's Indian Affairs Committee Deputy Staff Director Ebarb.
We really think it's a truly historic achievement for everyone, including American Indians and Alaska Natives, to get this across the line in the Senate in a bipartisan way. We also hope the House of Representatives will quickly pass the bill and the president signs it into law so we can put our work into action.
Two Royal Canadian Mounted Police officers in the Northwest Territories have been charged with assault. According to a release, the officers each face one count of assault from an incident in Yellowknife in October, quote, while lodging a woman in cells, end quote. Both officers continue to work for the Yellowknife RCMP detachment. They're expected to appear in court September 14th. Santo Domingo Pueblo cartoonist Ricardo Cate is one of seven recipients for the 2021 New Mexico's Governor's Award for Excellence in the Arts. This popular cartoon, Without Reservation, explores the irony and poignant humor in the Native American experience. For National Native News, I'm Trip Krause.
Washington state legislators have been working on a suite of bills that would reform policing and the criminal justice system in the state. One is House Bill 1140, signed into law by the governor this spring. It prohibits interrogation of suspects under the age of 18 until they've spoken with a lawyer. But the change faces pushback from state law enforcement. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade has more.
Washington law enforcement and youth justice advocates are at odds over a new law passed that has mandated juvenile suspects receive legal counsel before police questioning. House Bill 1140 goes into effect January of 2022, following Governor Jay Inslee's signing of it earlier this spring, and requires that any juvenile that is being questioned in connection with a crime to consult with an attorney before police or sheriff's deputies can interview them. The law renders statements made by juvenile suspects before consulting an attorney inadmissible at trial, with some exemptions allotted where the youth may be a victim to human trafficking or if someone's life is in imminent danger. Bill 1140 is part of a package of reform bills drafted in the wake of protests demanding police accountability stemming from the racial justice demonstrations of 2020. Advocates are saying the new law will prevent false confessions from youth coerced under pressure, extending the right to remain silent until adequate legal consultation. In a joint statement with the ACLU, Director of the King County Department of Public Defense, Anita Candenwall, said, quote, "This legislation means youth who are scared, confused, and vulnerable when stopped by police will receive critical legal advice. This bill ensures our youth are treated fairly," end quote. Critics of Bill 1140 maintain the law will hinder the ability to investigate crime. Sentiment from two of Yakima's top law enforcement officials are claiming that the new law will do more harm than good, with prosecuting attorney Joe Brusick saying, quote, "This is absolutely going to make it more difficult for law enforcement to obtain any information from a suspect under the age of 18. Yakima County Sheriff Bob Udell calls the law, quote, counterproductive, maintaining that juvenile suspects confronted with interrogation may be discouraged from entering a life of crime. Bill 1140's aim echoes 1989's Central Park 5 case, where a group of Latino and Black teenagers were wrongly convicted of raping a white woman in New York's Central Park. Those false confessions were vacated in 2002, after another man's confession verified DNA evidence linking him to the heinous crime. With the KABU Evening News, I am Jeffrey Wade.
Advocates for people with disabilities are urging Congress to boost Medicaid, home, and community-based services in the Better Care, Better Jobs Act, which would allocate $400 billion to increase access to care. Critics say the costs are too high and warn the move could lead to bigger government. Eric Galatis has the story in Colorado.
As infrastructure legislation makes its way through Congress, advocates for people with disabilities are urging lawmakers to boost investments in in-home care programs that would allow more people to avoid placement in nursing homes. Cristiano Sosa with ARC of Colorado says the Better Care, Better Jobs Act would dramatically improve quality of life for people with disabilities. Sosa adds the proposal would raise wages for caregivers and provide benefits, including paid family leave, which will help make direct care work a viable career path and reduce turnover.
One of the things that we hear loud and clear from individuals with disabilities and families is it's almost a full-time job just training the new person.
Caregiver reimbursements have not kept up with inflation or even local minimum wages, and Sosa sees the proposed $400 billion investment in Medicaid, home, and community-based services as an important step to reverse decades of underfunding. Congress has remained divided along party lines over so-called human infrastructure investments. Republicans say the price tag is too high and worry it would lead to bigger government. Lack of funding has led to long waiting lists for rationed in-home care services, which leaves many no choice but to turn to nursing homes. Henry Claypool with Brandeis University says blocking the proposal would be penny wise but pound foolish. States are required to accept nursing home residents regardless of their ability to pay, which costs taxpayers exponentially more than community-based care. Claypool believes the proposal is ultimately about giving people more options.
If you're in an institution like a nursing home, you're not able to get up and go when you want. You're totally dependent on when the staff can get to you. Most Americans really want to stay in their homes, and this is an important investment to make that happen.
Sosa notes if Congress does not invest in community care options, the burden will continue to fall on unpaid family caregivers, which have historically been women and people of color. Sosa adds the legislation should also boost recovery from the pandemic's economic fallout by providing good jobs for direct care workers and allowing family caregivers to rejoin the workforce. This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Colorado News Connection.
A group in Congress says the nation is experiencing a mental health crisis and is pressing to extend Medicaid postpartum coverage from the current 60-day limit to a full year. In Maryland, a state lawmaker is urging more action to address racial inequities in pregnancy outcomes. Diane Bernard has more.
Maternal mortality rates are higher for women of color, and it's an issue getting renewed attention, both from state and federal lawmakers. A Maryland legislator says the state needs to do more to prevent racial disparities in maternal health outcomes. Speaking at an online event on birthing inequities, Delegate Janelle Wilkins points to overall maternal mortality rates for Maryland women that dropped 16% from 2013 to 2017. But during the same time, she says, four times more Black and brown women died after giving birth than white women.
We also know from this information that most deaths are not happening at a hospital. They're not happening during pregnancy. A lot of times they're taking place after often a successful birth, within a couple days or a year after a birth has taken place.
More than 70 members of Congress also signed a letter this week to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, citing what they call a maternal health crisis. They're urging the agency to expand Medicaid postpartum coverage from the current 60 days to a year as part of the American Rescue Plan. Wilkins thinks the coverage expansion would be key to closing racial gaps and helping mothers stay healthy after giving birth. She explains Maryland launched a maternal mortality review committee about 20 years ago. A 2018 bill expanded the group to include folks to make recommendations based on health trends, but she says it doesn't go far enough.
One of the major issues that I've seen is having that true inclusion. That's something that we're still working on with the stakeholder group. I think it's important to recognize and that this legislation recognize the critical need to have those most impacted right there at the table.
Roughly 17 women die for every 100,000 live births in the U.S. That's more than double the ratio of maternal deaths than in other high-income countries. Nationally, Black and Indigenous women are 2 to 3 times more likely than white women to die from pregnancy-related complications. For Maryland News Connection, I'm Diane Bernard.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 13th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade and Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Trip Krause, Diane Bernard, Eric Galatas, Lily Bolke, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Sam Bowman. Good night.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, listeners to this show may take it as a given that if you care about social, racial, economic justice, you have to also care about media, because corporate news media promote narratives that shape public opinion, public policy, and all of our lives. Now we understand that tales that mainstream news media tell every day, healthcare for everyone is too expensive, people of color are the main source of crime, rich people contribute to the economy while workers just take from it, that those are not demonstrable truth, but instead reflect the interests and priorities of media owners and sponsors.